podcast of Toronto Believer, exploring, if you will, practical philosophy, from science of the workings of the mind to spirituality, esotericism, and magic. Stooping down, dipping my wings, I came into the darkly splendid abodes. Is Crowley's approach to yoga still relevant? And who was Crowley's yoga teacher? Did famed comedy film director Preston Sturges' mother dictate book 4 to Crowley at the behest of an entity called Abul Diz? And what can we learn from the record of their communication with Abul Diz? Stay tuned for the answers in the season 4 finale, Frothy Sexy Summer Reading List.
Hey, so one kind
of... I thought you were going to casually be like, hey, do what thou wilt, shall be the whole of the law.
Love is the law, love it or will. Hey, we've started. Great.
Yeah. Welcome to our casual episode.
Yeah. I don't sound like I'm at the bottom of a well. I apologize to the people for meeting you in person today,
yeah.
But I was lonely, so I wanted to come
we had a conceit
look into
going.
A man's eyes.
We had a conceit going of having you phone in from the aether.
I bought a new cellular phone, and then the port doesn't port my broken ass headphones in.
Yeah.
So I don't have a microphone that I could plug into this new phone easily.
What Michael means is that he doesn't have an interdimensional nexus transformer that would normally help him to get in from that place that he usually calls in from, between worlds.
Yeah, that's right. I reside in the astral realm. Very good.
Imagination is fun.
I tried to re-listen to some of the episodes of the season. I usually go back over all the material and, you know,
it's been a long one.
Try
this
to
time.
Correct my mistakes. I find myself very annoying this year.
Oh,
I thought
you were going to be like, I was very erudite and
I've been
made
starting a lot of arguments with you for no reason.
I felt the same way about myself.
I'm really feeling.
Although I have a reason. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to get views.
Oh, I see.
I'm trying to get clicks. No, I thought.
I think if we want to argue, we have to be less passive aggressive because
I don't know if
apologizing in advance for insulting someone is as clickbaity as just
I don't know if it. WrestleMania would be doing its numbers if they were doing it passive aggressive.
Oh no, did you want to talk? Why don't you say something first and then I'll finish my idea. Yeah, no, I've been really winding myself up. But is there anything from the reading we've done in the last year that's sort of sticking with you? Anything you're that's continuing to eat away at your consciousness?
Well, I mean, we've had a lot going on. Maybe we could even just recap a little bit of. I mean, the biggest thing I think was the biggest sort of thread that was consistent was Hume,
mm-hmm.
and the subjects pertaining thereto. We had that sort of following us, obviously, through the couple of Hume episodes, which are probably the least highly viewed or listened to. But and then we had that sort of flow through, you know, things like Notes on an Astral Atlas and some of the other pieces as well in and out. So that seemed highly thematic.
Yeah, I it was sort of a shame after the Hume episode because we try not to do too much peripheral reading. And one of the things that happens is if I do any peripheral reading at all, I come in thinking I know something and then I yell at you about it for an hour. So it's better if we neither of us know anything and then we can talk about our opinions, but
and we can passive aggressively respond to each other's opinions, like with okay.
I think that's
didn't think of it that way, but if that's how you think of it,
but skepticism in terms of philosophy, formal skepticism, is sort of these are people who doubt that knowledge is possible.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think I'd always been sort of naively reading it as naive rationalists, you know, like just the sort of default view of I'll believe it when I see it, you know, like, and so when Crowley, who always seems to be on the fence about like belief in God versus, you know, versus taking what he would think of as sort of a critical, skeptical approach, you know, like in The Soldier and the Hunchback or something where he's like, you got to keep chasing these ideas, you know, really working hard to find the limits of rationalism and know what you can know. So when he's talking about the essays of David Hume being masterpieces of skepticism, I kind of thought that he meant that, you know, masterpieces of modern atheism or something, you know, which is totally anachronistic. So it's nice to now know what that means, is that it means we doubt that knowledge is possible. And of course, there's a whole, I keep talking about idealists because it's the only branch of philosophy from which I've actually done some, excerpted some reading. And it seems to me like idealism might be like a response to skepticism or something. It's like, oh, we can't know anything. It's like, oh, well, at least I can know that I'm thinking. It's like, okay, maybe thoughts are the only things, like the Berkeley. And so, so kind of recontextualizing Hume as a person who like not only doesn't believe in miracles or does believe in miracles, as we were kind of squabbling about, or like, you know, the idea of like, oh, because miracles aren't evidence for everything, anything, so we have to take Christianity on faith. Like, that's not actually the core issue. Like the thing is, what is it even possible to know? And is knowing possible? And I think Hume's trying to figure out how we can continue to do science, even though maybe we know that knowing isn't actually possible. But I thought that was a weird bit of color that we can, that it's to have missed, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And it is incredibly important as well. Like, I mean, you have people who are into Thelema in the way that it seems to be talked about on the internet. Although I have to catch myself there, because a lot of what I hear on the internet about people talking about Thelema is people criticizing the way that people talk about Thelema. So, yeah, that's probably not really helpful just to assume that.
That's correct,
you know.
Right. That when people are criticizing other people's attitude towards Thelema, right? Like, people are always, the first thing you ever hear anyone say about Thelema is like, do what thou wilt doesn't mean do what you want.
Yeah.
You know, I think people often misunderstand that. Well, are people really often misunderstanding that if that's the first thing anyone ever says about it?
Yeah, if you're constantly hit by that between the eyes.
Yeah, it seems like the misunderstanding might actually be that that we should still have strict moral philosophical, you know, Hasidic sort of rigorous systems where we can, oh, don't worry, you can continue repressing all of your instincts and ideas and fitting in with social society, even though you're a Thelemite. It's totally okay. That might be the real misunderstanding.
Yeah, I think that's really the issue, is that people take on Thelema and then it sort of it slumps back into whatever their default position already was. So they're not, it's not challenging them anymore. It just becomes a different hat to put on.
I read an article. I was trying to figure out who Crowley's Indian yoga teacher was. And it turns out I may have been wrong. Maybe he didn't actually have a direct Indian yoga teacher. Maybe it was Alan Bennett the whole time. But this person who was sometimes the Solicitor General of Ceylon was Bennett's yoga teacher. And so when Crowley was in Ceylon studying with Bennett, Bennett was then going and studying with this guy. Although it's hard to imagine that the three of them would all not have met if they were all in the same city at the same time, and Crowley being so tenacious and saying like, hey, can you introduce me to your master? You know, you're communicating all this valuable information to me. I was looking at an article today where what Crowley actually said about this guy was excerpted in several places. And mostly he was saying how much Bennett learned from this person. But one of the articles I stumbled into when I was trying to remember this piece of information was this person who was complaining that Crowley messed up in teaching yoga because he has this one offhanded remark about how you have to learn to sit still with every muscle tense for, you know, hours at a time. And he thought, oh, Crowley's a masochist. You know, you don't want to tense every muscle. Asana means that which is comfortable and easy. This seems to me to be not the biggest deviation that Crowley makes. His biggest thing is summarizing yama and niyama as do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law, love is the law, love under will. Mm-hmm. Whereas usually there's a whole bunch of prescriptive precepts given, right? Like the yogi should be homeless, or the yogi should not receive gifts, or the yogi should practice ahimsa, non-violence, by not only not starting fights, but by being a vegetarian and, you know, not, you know, non-killing, I think is mm-hmm. How it works. And I was thinking a little bit about this as I was practicing yoga and also looking at film of other people talking about their practice of yoga and how, oh, you know, over the course of several years and months, my wife noticed that I was a different person, that some of my, you know, personality complexes seemed to be easing themselves out. I was more tolerable to be around, you know, I wasn't, you know, as anxious or starting meaningless arguments quite so much because of my practice of yoga. And I kind of started to think that if you're, you know, sitting on the mat for, say, you know, 2 or 3 25-minute sessions every day, but this breath work is tied in your mind to a highly prescriptive practice of moral behavior,
mm-hmm.
then part of what you're doing is grooving in these moral precepts as you unconsciously, perhaps, as you do, you know, your breath work or whatever it is. And so the fact that we see people who practice yoga with the formal yamas and niyamas in place beginning to embody those virtues more and more is not necessarily surprising. And it doesn't necessarily say anything about the practice of yoga itself, nor does it necessarily say anything about what God actually wants from us. You know, it's like, oh, you know, I stopped eating meat and at first it was really hard, but I did all this breath work and became enlightened. And now it's easy for me not to eat meat. Therefore, God doesn't want me to eat meat. It's like the criticism that Nietzsche makes of moral philosophers, where, you know, every individual moral philosophy seems defensible in and of itself. There's no universal standard, and people seem to be actually just rationalizing what they already believe. And so for Crowley to sort of remove that part and say, no, what's really important is that you have a lifestyle conducive to regular meditation and that you're not distracted, but otherwise, you know, learning your true will and doing that and doing nothing else will be the fulfillment of your commitment to yama and niyama as you do practice. It sort of opens you up to the possibility of receiving real divine guidance in your meditation rather than continuing to follow this prescriptive system, you know.
That makes sense. That actually is a good argument for using do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law, and love is the law, love under will, for these ideas of yama, because of the fact that it disentangles it from those moral precepts. If you think of it this way, it's sort of like if you have a race of people like the Spartans who are completely design their society, and I'm gonna go over the top with this, like with the general, you know, movie 300 kind of version of things. But like you have them basically organizing their society around battle and warfare and training and this sort of thing. You have that, then obviously you're inculcating yourself with the idea, the morals, so to speak, of war being good, or battle, being in battle and being good and that sort of thing. So in the same way that you're talking about with inculcating yourself with these morals that are associated with not eating of meat, not causing of violence and that sort of thing. So that sort of makes it seem like, well, the tool is focused on refining itself as a tool, And so its context, its morals in its own context, are dictated by the purpose of that tool, the purpose to which that tool is set, and the way in which it is properly honed and cared for.
Crowley seems to be open to this process of discovery in a way that other yoga teachers maybe pay lip service to, but don't.
Yeah,
or people don't as openly embrace as much as they.
People fall into this trap of thinking, well, my yama worked for me, therefore everybody else needs this yama as well.
Right, right, and especially when that's, you know, many centuries of prescriptive practice, mm-hmm. right? It begins to be clear that this is some sort of cultural tool for, you know, building exemplary people that we want to exemplify in our culture. Not that there's anything specifically wrong with that, but the thelemic approach allows people to become individuals rather than not that the other thing necessarily wouldn't, but more fully morally individuals with their own sort of guiding principles.
Yeah, this is actually a really useful way of thinking about this. I feel like we're unlocking something to it because, I mean, even coming to the point where Crowley sort of refers to the idea that whatever you grew up in, the culture that you grew up in, the religion that you grew up with, the sort of context that you were raised in, you don't want to throw that out entirely in the sense of completely trying to pretend like now I'm, this totally other thing. Not that you have to continue to be a Muslim if you were raised as a Muslim, but that is going to inform quite a bit of how you find your true will, how you understand your true will.
This is worth thinking about, and we're not the first people to do it. I know I sort of try not to read books by living people, but there's a Tobias Chertin book. He's got this ongoing project of doing this like multi-volume biography of Crowley. He's got a couple biographies that are full biographies and then other ones that are sort of like excerpts of moments of a life or something like that. And I've read a few pages of some of them and did not enjoy it. I don't love his writing, but he does have a book on Crowley in India, which might be worth reading. And then Gordon, I'm sorry, Gordon, what's your name? Gordon Jurif or something like this Canadian guy from
BC.
Yeah. He wrote a sort of more academic paper about Crowley's relationship with India and Indian Eastern teachings and stuff like that, that might be worth looking at some point, too.
That would be great, yeah.
I wonder, you're a little bit more plugged in than I am. I haven't made any attempt to get back on Facebook, and I am not going to these meetings that you're scheduling a couple times a month with the local scene. Do you think that people think of Crowley as authoritative? Like, if a Thelemite really wanted to learn something about like an authentic yoga tradition, do you think they would trust what they read in, book four and 8 lectures, or would they be more inclined to start somewhere else first? What's the pulse? What's the zeitgeist?
I think that it really seems to me that the impression I get is everybody, generally speaking, doesn't feel it necessary to sort of choose one or the other kind of thing. Mm. So there's like plenty of people who are exploring, whatever they feel called to explore, frankly. So if you have people who are interested in yoga, they'll be exploring that in different ways. So they may be taking on yoga teachers. They may be reading books by various authors and that sort of thing. So which I think is good. I think that's what we want, sure. Rather than people just sort of saying, no, I read what Crowley wrote and that's it.
Yeah, I think that's a healthy attitude. What I'm more wondering is, I think in some circles there's a a fear of cultural appropriation more generally, and that maybe white people shouldn't study yoga at all, or that if you're going to learn yoga, you wouldn't want to learn yoga from a white person or something like this. But also, I think there's specifically a prejudice against Crowley, where he's seen as, you know, a liar and a charlatan, and even people who, like Thelema, are bound to be skeptical of him because, oh, he said racist things sometimes, so maybe he's we probably can just write off half of what he says about anything.
Well, this gives me an opportunity to address something that I've been feeling like, and this might be angry man, angry old man shouts at cloud kind of territory, but I really think that there's a dichotomy between the way that people interact and whatnot online versus when you're actually dealing with people in person. Mm. And this is one of the reasons that I'm a big advocate for in-person interaction. And I deal with the online stuff, but only insofar as it's necessary these days in order to facilitate the in-person stuff. And sometimes it's kind of nice to do some online stuff as well. But I think there's like a psychological thing that goes on with people when they're just online all the time, even if they're not just online all the time. But the way that it colors people's interactions with each other and their way of thinking and their way of being polarized and that sort of thing, it's like you get, especially here with Toronto Thelema, where we're like, we're fostering an environment where discussion is possible as opposed to arguments, you know?
Right.
So, like, with what you're talking about, for instance, the cultural appropriation fears and that sort of thing, that's silly to me. And I don't see it in these in-person interactions and that sort of thing. I think it's one of those, like, it strikes me as one of those things that people who are online arguing over the subject are going to get obsessive about.
I see.
You know what I mean?
So yoga comes to the West, I think, in sort of three major waves, and they're individuals who do the bringing. There's Swami Vivekananda in about the 1850s, sort of in and around the spiritualist movement, and he writes a book that Thelemites are supposed to read called Raja Yoga, as well as other ones, which talk about the eight limbs of yoga, you know, asana, pranayama, yama niyama, pratyahara, dharana, dhyana, and samadhi, in almost the way Crowley does. Book four, part one, is very similar structure to the Raja Yoga, and then the back three quarters of Raja Yoga is a translation and long commentary on Patanjali, the Yoga Suttas of Patanjali. And so the reason to include the Yoga Suttas of Patanjali is because that's the book that sets up these kind of eight limbs and talks about, you know, but the suttas are, sutta means like, not quite like aphorism, but, and we should maybe read the Yoga Suttas at some point, if only to see how frustrating they are, because a lot of layers of interpretation have to be put on them before you go like, okay, sit still for an hour. You know, it's not explicit as far as I'm concerned in the sutras, but we might read it and find that I'm wrong. And then the second wave is in the 1920s. Yogananda, is his name Paramahansa Yogananda comes over and founds the East Meets West Society, which, and later that's taken over by a Western person, one of his disciples, and becomes the Self-Realization Fellowship or something like this. Mm-hmm. And Yogananda is very focused on these particular techniques that he calls Kriya Yoga. He doesn't write about them for public consumption. If you want to learn them, now you can, but that's very new, only in about the last 5 or 10 years has it been able, have you been able to learn these techniques online? Usually they're passed on only through his little cult, and they're very focused on breathing techniques. And then later on, I think maybe in the 50s or it's the 70s, the big one is BKS Iyengar, who claims to be teaching from the Hatha Yoga Pradipika, and maybe with his direct disciples he is, but it's much, much more about the system of formalized exercise, physical exercise. which is the way everybody practices yoga now, based on Iyengar's teachings. And my understanding of this is that Iyengar's master at some point was teaching British soldiers in India and had to design a system of yoga that would work for what he called martial people. Mm. And so the yoga that he was teaching was only one generation old and was sort of an attempt to sort of make a martial art out of yoga that would be very rigorous physical discipline that would hold the attention of soldiers, basically. I might be getting this wrong, but that's kind of the story I heard long ago. And so what we all practice today, you know, if you go to Downward Dog, which is a big yoga studio in Toronto that's very good and has very large classes, and then, you know, get in physical shape and then do their teacher training, you might be able to do this without ever hearing, you know, without ever reading the Yoga Sutras, or if you do, reading them very superficially, and then not really practicing Dharana, Dhyana, Samadhi. You know, you'd be focused on this sort of physical discipline. And if you actually read the Hatha Yoga Pradipika, it's bonkers. Like, it's not, it's not about, it's not about, you know, sun salutations. It's about drinking pee through the nose and caffing yourself with reeds and trying to, you know, suck river water up into your urethra to train the muscles of your bladder to sort of do sucking motions. Anyway, it's weird. And so where Crowley fits into all this is founding the AA in about 1907, and teaching basically what Vivekananda taught, but also telling people to read Vivekananda, telling people to read the Shiva Sanhita, telling people to read the Hatha Yoga Pradipika, communicating what he learned from Alan Bennett, who also learned from, I have the guy's name here, who also learned from...
General of Ceylon.
The Solicitor General of Ceylon. Ceylon's basically government lawyer, whose name was...
I'll insert a drum roll.
I didn't take the photo that I thought I took.
Oh, good. It's a disappointing drum roll.
Ramanathan.
Ramanathan.
And he, by the way, was mainly a lawyer, but he was noted for his spiritual teachings as well, and was one of the first people to sort of do gospel commentaries saying that the disciples of Christ were practicing yoga. Mm. That later also became a big part of Yogananda's message as well. So, and this is not an exhaustive list. There's also people like David Lynch. What's this guy's name?
The
transcendental meditation people. But what happens is all these people are teaching very specific sort of secret techniques. And trying to attract disciples, it's. But if you want to learn the core sort of precepts of real, you know, authentic Indian meditation, which was sort of how yoga first came to the West with Vivekananda trying to do these, you know, trying to teach the Shiva, Hatha Yoga Pradipika. I don't think you can do much better than Crowley, who is who has done all this reading, comes very early before the sort of, you know, midway through that first wave teaching, has studied with a direct disciple of a popular Indian master of the time, is also reading contemporary authors, another fellow whose name is... another fellow whose name is Ananda K. Kormaraswamy, who is writing very esoteric stuff about rigorous meditation, very complicated meditation process. Crowley's reading this and trying to integrate some of that into his teaching. So, and the advantage is that Crowley's a native English speaker, writing in English with a certain amount of personal attainment. He believed that he had samadhi experiences himself. And he wants you to read the ancient classics as well as the modern writers that he's reading too. So I think it's, I think that you're pretty lucky if you learn reading Crowley,
yeah,
learn yoga from reading Crowley.
And the idea that it's cultural appropriation misses the point that it's using this as a tool,
mm-hmm.
and it's using it in conjunction with other tools as well.
Well, I just wonder if there are other people out there who are as inclined to what Crowley calls vital skepticism as I am,
mm-hmm.
like where they just read things and just knee-jerk reaction is not to believe them. Like when I first picked up the Confessions and Crowley's talking about all of his mountain climbing adventures and saying like, oh, I broke this record. I was in correspondence with, these British mountain climbing organizations and magazines. And, you know, they were writing me off because my approach was too innovative. I just thought like, none of this happened. You never went mountain climbing one day in your life. These people don't exist. These magazines may exist, but you never wrote to them. You're just lying. And when I read Crowley on yoga, and I thought like, this doesn't say anything about sun salutations. You know, he's just using the word yoga incorrectly. He means meditation, but he doesn't know what yoga is.
Mm-hmm.
And this is useful for Thelemites, but it's Thelemic yoga. It's not real. You know, it's not authentic.
It's the same thing as Kabbalah, right? It's like there's, you know, some contention. It's like, well, if you want true Jewish Kabbalah, then you go over here and do this.
Yeah.
And it's like,
well, with Kabbalah, it's more true that Crowley's Kabbalah is not the Kabbalah, but it is the Hermetic tradition of Kabbalah going back about 400 years before him.
Yeah.
And he's plugged into that line.
And that's the same point when it comes to the yoga thing, right? It's an interesting discussion to talk about whether it's true yoga or if it diverges from cultural tradition in various ways and that sort of thing. But to make that as an argument against it is just nonsensical.
Well, yeah, I mean, whether it's no, you know what? You may be right? Because Crowley doesn't tell you to calf yourself with reeds.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't tell you to, you know, try to suck river water up into your bladder. He doesn't tell you to practice natty by flossing your nasal passages with cotton. He doesn't tell you to drink urine through the nose or any of these other sort of practices that you read about if you read the books he tells you to read.
And he also diverges from the yama ideas as well.
That's right. But the way he teaches yoga is very, very much like the way Indians try to teach yoga to Westerners. The couple of things missing is he doesn't have like a secret technique that you have to go to him to learn. He's teaching the fundamentals, and he doesn't try to pretend that it's Christian.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas after Vivekananda, the other major waves of yoga will be like, yeah, Jesus was a
yoga
teacher.
Where do you think he was before?
Yeah, yeah. So there, and Crowley tries to be. One other thing that's sort of missing is the kind of like visualization aspect. He'll teach you these mechanical techniques, but maybe miss out what you're supposed to be thinking about while you do them. And so you do have to kind of have a broader base of reading than just the two Crowley books. But the reason I bring this up is that there's a sort of case study here about how well-read Crowley actually is, and that he's not just initiating into Masonic cults, doing what they tell him, believing it on faith, and then regurgitating it, or just fucking making up techniques whole cloth, which he sometimes does, and sometimes they're even good. But that when he starts talking about what Kabbalah is within the Hermetic tradition, he's communicating authentic information. When he's talking about yoga, that really is the way Indians communicate about yoga to white
and
people.
It's for a purpose too. It's not like we're practicing Kabbalah because we want to carry on the traditions of Judaism and the culture that comes along with that and that sort of thing. That's not what we're focused on. We're focused on these things as tools for a particular purpose, with a particular purpose in mind.
I also think there's a way in which people think that like, oh, that was 100 years ago. We've made so much progress now.
That is a common sentiment.
You know, like Crowley's writing about yoga is fine for what it was. But like if I go to down dog and meet a living yoga teacher, then I'm connected to a living tradition, and that's somehow better.
As if Aristotle doesn't matter anymore.
Yeah, well, but the problem is, right, in lots of Western disciplines, like we've talked about this with chemistry before, you can learn all of chemistry in 4 years, no matter how much chemistry there is. Hmm. You know, every new generation makes new leaps in a new direction, and that just gets integrated into the curriculum, and then you're expected to learn it all in 4 years, and then in your doctoral research make another leap forward. And so many things that are like Western disciplines stack in this way where the new generation actually is more correct. But when you're talking about spiritual insight and like yoga or something, it's like the people who are doing the work of becoming saints and actually get there, you know, don't just then find a couple of disciples and train them to be even better saints than I was. The tradition gets watered down over a period of years until someone else is finally inspired to reach up and attain that. So the going back to, so if you identify someone who you think of as like a great saint in some tradition, there's so much value in going back to what they communicated, because they're doing it from the perspective of someone who's actually attained this level, and then their work degrades as it's passed on from teacher to student. It doesn't improve in the way other intellectual disciplines seem to.
Yeah, and I think that's actually a common thing that comes up for people, and I feel like there's a tendency to want to innovate things. And I feel like that tends to be bereft of the viewpoint that I think is useful, which is that all of these people talking about and working towards these ideas pertaining to enlightenment, or however you want to parse it, these spiritual sort of goals and practices and things, and the results that you get from them. If these are not just our imagination, or we're not just making these things up, then there's a real principle behind it. You could say a natural existing function or principle that exists whether we do or not, in a sense. So therefore, throughout history, you're going to have people engaging with this. It's always going to be the same principle, in the same way that water will turn to ice under the right conditions. And so the desire to innovate, I think, tends to be kind of like missing that point, you know? So that like a lot of people nowadays keep trying to innovate by creating – it's like, well, there's been so much learned since Crowley's time, so it completely makes him obsolete, as if we're just seeing constant progress. You know, it's that something that's always been there, I'm sure, for human beings to some extent or another. But especially since the Industrial Revolution, I feel like there's this sense that we're constantly making progress forward rather than being able to take into account all the thousands upon thousands of years before the Industrial Revolution, you know, and what happened during those periods.
I mean, certain things that Crowley might want you to read in the sciences might seem dated now, or this is worth sort of talking about more, and maybe a good reason to read Gordon's paper, if we can get a hold of it. Because I'd be curious what someone who'd done, you know, more than 15 minutes research on this would have to say.
Yeah.
But I mean, even this issue of asana, oh, Crowley wants you to sit still with every muscle tight, you know? He says that the traditional yoga postures are not suitable for the European constitution. And that sounds racist. What it means is most people can't do lotus posture unless they've been doing it since they were kids, right? Because your hips get locked up. And so he's given you a number of other alternatives for postures that you can train, including the God posture, which is just sitting in a straight back chair. And other people that I've been, you know, researching as living descendants of the Yogananda system, the Kriya Yoga system, more than one of them has talked about the important thing is that your back straight and that you don't fall asleep. So try sitting in a straight backed chair. Like, it's just the way it it's just the sort of open quotes innovations end quotes that Crowley makes are just the way people end up talking about it when they encounter a sort of, you know, Western constitution. You know, this thing about homelessness, right? Where, oh, you're supposed to go to an ashram and learn all the basics and then maybe either become a teacher at the ashram or, you know, go out and become a wandering saint and live in the desert or, you know, wander the Himalayas. But if you live in a colder climate and you need a job, you know, one person I said, yeah, the idea embodying this idea of homelessness just means non-attachment.
Yeah.
You know, you can have a home, but as you travel, you know, for work or for pleasure or you go around teaching yoga seminars or whatever you do, you know, wherever you are, you're bringing your home with you, you know, it's a total cop-out as far as I'm concerned in terms of observing the traditional yamas and niyamas, but these things get negotiated with because different people in different cultures at different times have different requirements for meeting their material needs. And so you can condemn Crowley for his innovations if you like, but they're the same innovations that other yoga teachers have made when trying to come and communicate in the same environment, you know, when there's not a cultural tradition that like thinks begging is honorable, you know, this guy's devoted his life to spiritual practice. I can give him a cup of rice twice a week rather than kicking someone and throwing change at their face. You know, there are different, there just are different.
Yeah. It's a different
cultural baggage and these innovations are necessary to communicate the work and get people to that place of ultimate attainment.
So. Yeah. So it is worthwhile sort of looking into the context and remembering to look into what the purpose of the exercises are as best you can. Whereas like, you know, maybe it's not as clear cut. Maybe it's easy to rationalize your way out of them by saying, well, because I'm a Westerner, I don't have to do X or I can sort of intellectualize X and not have to really engage with it. But no, it's like, remembering what the purpose of these things is, what they're supposed to be doing to you, and then intellectualizing it doesn't actually do the job of that. You actually have to go through putting it into practice in order to gain the benefits of it.
We sort of started by saying, was there anything this season that stuck in your mind? And I've been kind of wondering about this IAO formula a little bit and thinking that I need to go back and reread at least the application of it across different aeons. I think it's obvious that Crowley believes in magic. He devotes his whole life to it. But often the way he talks about it sucks a lot of the mystery away. You know, his famous introduction to book 4, part 3, where he has all these axioms that make everything sound mechanical. You know, if you want to turn on a light, you have to flip the right switch or something like this. It sort of takes the spookiness away from the magical act. Yeah. And then we mentioned Crowley's play The Ship, which sort of has some long poems that seem to be claims on immortality, but it's explicitly John the Younger reading these poems, dedicating them to his dead father. So it's the most mundane kind of immortality where, you know, your progeny carries on your lineage or, you know, to more generously, perhaps your student or something like that. It's very unmagical. In the way in which the IAO formula becomes kind of like this idea of procreation and begins with, what does he call it? Parthenogenesis, and then the normal sexual formula. And then, in modern times that like valve, IAO valve, where there's something essentially the same at the beginning and the end, but it's been through this kind of purification and refinement process. I kind of just this morning was wondering if like maybe there's some glimpse of something more magical, more spooky in that, like if people are androgyne, does that mean we've returned to an idea of sort of self-procreation, self-refine, you know, that life is more focused on, I think it's obvious that life is more focused on individuals now, but does that have spookier implications that I haven't grasped from reading the text and discussing it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I do feel like a deeper engagement with that IAO formula is well worthwhile. In some ways, I feel like Crowley was still, you know, even though he's speaking very authoritatively on that subject at the time, I feel like the sense I get in a lot of these formulae that he's explicating on, he's kind of like, they're works in progress, you know? Later right. on in life, I'm sure he had a further nuanced insight into these same formulae. But it's hard to 100% say, you know?
I tell you one thing that has not stayed with me for one second is the Chaldean oracles of Zoroaster. I have not thought about that again even one time.
Yeah, it didn't have the I can understand why. It's a little bit like it seemed really important to them at the time around the Golden Dawn and all that sort of thing. So
yeah, but what was important about it is not true. There are things that are true about it that could be important, but the way was it Westcott? The way Westcott put it together was false and fanciful.
Yeah.
And doesn't tell us anything about Zoroaster.
It's a bit like seeing an image in a cloud, like a sheep or a
I'm springing this on you. I didn't warn you about it in advance at all. You're blown.
What the?
You can't believe it. I wanted to read something with you because I said a lot of messed up shit about the reception and or writing of magic and theory and practice.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, nothing I said was applicable to magic and theory and practice. there's this story about the writing of book 4, which for Crowley was only those first two, was books 4, part 1 and part 2 initially, and then theory and practice came along much, much later.
Mm-hmm.
We wondered if it was around the Cefalu period or something. Books 4, part 1 and 2 were 1909, so quite early. And then I think theory and practice was maybe 1929, so much, much later.
Okay, yeah.
But I've been reading The King of the Shadow Realm, which is one of the John Simmons biographies of Crowley. And I think if I came across it in the real world, I would have just ignored it. Because I think the publication date on this is something like 1989 or something like this, quite late. And so just, I figured it was just part of the whole 90s magical revival thing where people are just writing. But John Simmons turns out to be more interesting than that. He knew Crowley, which is surprising when you consider this book is more than 40 years removed from Crowley's life, but I guess he was an older man when he published it. This is his third biography of Crowley, and he was Crowley's literary executor, so you see his name on some of the earlier OTO publications.
Yeah, I'd read this book. It's like The Aeon of Mott. I forget the exact title, but it was letters from Frater Ahad between him and Gerald York, I believe it was. And the subject comes up where, I guess, during Crowley's final days or years, he was arranging with John Simmons to write his biography.
Okay.
And but after the fact, after Crowley had died and everything, there was like some displeasure taken at the nature of his ultimate biography that would first follow that. The B666, The Life of Aleister Crowley. And I think it was very kind of lurid and that sort of thing. So,
well, that's the thing is it's weird because Simmons seems to despise Crowley for a number of very specific reasons. And he keeps saying throwaway things like he was incapable of friendship. He was incapable of love. He was incapable of introspection.
Maybe he was like secretly talking about himself.
And almost all of Crowley's spiritual revelations can be traced back to his fractious relationship with his parents, you know, because he never, he didn't get the nurturing that he deserved. Somehow he grew up with these malformations and his dreams and spiritual insights are all sort of manifestations of the bad mother that he, you know. He still thinks Thelema is important enough to devote his entire working life to publishing about it. So that says something. And also, I don't think it's true that Crowley's totally incapable of introspection. But John Simmons knew the man, and I didn't. And if it's even true that Crowley was sort of bad at introspection or introspected less than the average person, if your initiatory body, you know, if your whatever lineage of the AA you're a member of or whatever other, you know, initiatory system you're involved in is obsessed with union, you know, with Carl Jung, self-analysis, or, you know, really pushes that introspective angle, you can start to wonder whether, if the guy who invented Thelema is supposed to be incapable of introspection, what is the value of introspection to the system that he designed? Is it working the way it should be? You know, this is a question you can ask yourself.
I really say that if you read Crowley's writings, he's very self-aware, and he seems very introspective to me. He seems very very capable of digging into himself. So I don't know what people are reading that they get this, but maybe in person he was a very, you know.
Well, one of the things Simmons complains about is Crowley has a record of all the things he was dreaming. You know, he's like alone in America and he's keeping a record of his dreams. And he had been reading books by Jung and other sort of books on psychology and symbolism. But Simmons is kind of annoyed that Crowley never makes any attempt in these diaries to do any analysis of the dreams. He just records them cold, he says, as if he's remembering a cool horror movie that he watched. You know, like there's all these dreams that in Simmons' interpretation mean things, and Crowley never even asks the question.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is one small piece of evidence for a larger thesis that he's just whole cloth incapable of introspection. But I wanted to read some, because there's a bunch of things in here that are cool. There's some excerpts here from a diary where him and you were right. It's Mary Sturgis are working together to just do something. You know, I don't think they have a goal in mind, but they're told that they're going to be given a book, and so they spend several days negotiating with this spirit, not Amalantra, but Abuldiz. How am I going to get this book? Where's the book? What do you mean? What's the book about? What's it called?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and sometimes they're told it's called book number 9, and sometimes they're told it's called book number 4. And
I think he finds himself, in retrospect, he ends up like feeling like he's overtaxing the spirits with his questioning and whatnot.
Well, he's like, where's this book? He's like, oh, do you have a black bookshelf in Boleskine? It's on the black bookshelf in Boleskine. Crowley's like, I think I have brown bookshelves in Boleskine.
Like,
no, black. I don't remember. I don't think I have any black bookshelves. It's on the black bookshelf in Boleskine. So they end up having to write the book themselves. So it looks like Mary Sturgis is called 2 or 3 different things in this text, but Crowley seems to be consistently called Perturabo. So why don't you read the lines for Perturabo? Because that'll be more straightforward, and I'll read both Abuldiz and Seer. So it begins with Crowley declaring himself as Frater Nemo.
Quis nomen est Nemo? whose name is no one.
Yeah, it begins with Crowley declaring himself, and then Mary Sturgis says, "The white man is here, and he wants to know what you want."
"Nothing. Did I call him or he me?"
"He called you, but there is 7-7.
"Why did you call me?"
"To give you this book."
"How will it be given?"
"By the seeress."
"Do you claim to be a brother of the AA?"
"He has AA in black letters on his breast, but they are always turning into a 7.
"What does AA mean?" So at that point, it is recorded that Albaldez was showing numbers very quickly, but no definite proof of his genuineness or even at this stage of his reality was established. "Give further signs of your identity. For example, are you sapiens dominabitur astris?"
"I see nothing but a skull."
"Is Deo Duque Comete Ferro one of you?"
"No, no longer."
"Do you know this word, Makashana?"
"He writes it in gold and after puts it a black cross."
"Ask who breathes."
"The black man. Now he has a white turban."
"Ask Albaldez to send him away unless he serves some purpose."
"Let Perturabo finish the word Baal."
"Balada? Is that right?"
"No. Ask me about 9.
"Consider yourself asked."
9 is the number of pages in a book."
"What book?"
"A book of voyages."
"We have none in stock. What book?"
"A book of fools."
"What book of fools?"
"I won't tell you."
"Please tell me."
"He says the name should be that of 7 virgins, and I won't be a virgin."
"What is that name?" And he repeats this question several times between long pauses.
2 or 3 times he has shown me the letter V and I.
"Is it the seeress's fault or Perturabo's fault that these communications are so futile? Or his own?"
"If you can translate 9, you won't find it futile."
"Well, how can I identify this book? Is there a copy now and here?"
"No."
"Where can I find it?"
"In London."
"In my office?"
"Are there black bookshelves in your office?"
"Dark brown."
"No, black."
"I don't think so."
"The book is marked with a crown and under it, 21.
"Further details, please."
He shows another book with a blazing sun, and it's the cover of it are of gold. "The book 4, your instructions to the brothers."
"Then I'm not to publish it."
Albaldez gives the sign of silence. He assumes thumb to lips in the gesture of Hippocrates.
"I understand by that I am not to publish it."
"Never, never, 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 never. But you are to find it." He shows a gold ring.
"Any letters?"
"I don't believe he said at all what he came to say."
"Let him dictate slowly and clearly his message. I will go and look for this book 4 if I have sufficient direction." "Does he wish to go on with this very unsatisfactory conversation?"
"Go to London and find book 4 and return it to the brothers."
"Where is book 4?
"In London."
"Where in London?"
"Do you know any place in London called the Sign of the New Moon?"
"Probably dozens."
And then he just says, "Goodbye." 7-7-7-7, goodbye. A few days later, they're trying again.
"Ad sum," which is to say, "I am present. How shall I get this book 4?
"It is waiting for you in London."
"I don't want the rational answer. I want the absurd."
1,429.
"Enlarge on this."
10. "It's all about water."
"Tell me more."
"You disdained the ship I offered you. The ship was number 1, with the head of a negro, golden beak, white breast. In Abeldez's hand is a wand with golden spearhead. Now Perturabo, dressed in white, steps into the vision. 29, red, 29, 39, don't waste time. Read 69. Albaldez is now in black, the room by incense. His name is I Am."
"What is my name?"
"Ham."
"What is the seeress's name?"
7 Hebrew characters.
"Out of which name?"
"Mystic name."
"Which?"
"A starry heaven."
"Your name?"
"Virakam." "The brothers are turning red on the 9th. White bell rolling on, able to see from side to side. Never fails. They're placing academic robes on Perturabo at a chain with a cross. They vote 9 votes cast. 2 will not be cast."
What do they vote about?
I can't find out. I wish you would let me go. Let me go. I can't decide at all.
You have my sympathy.
I don't think reading all of this is absolutely necessary, but do you see my where my confusion came from when I was saying I thought the text had been received? Because he keeps promising to give it to them,
mm-hmm.
Or saying that the book is already written and they just need to go to London and find it on a bookshelf.
Yeah,
and by the end of this, they are instructed to they are instructed to go to Italy and find it there,
mm-hmm.
And then finally they end up. Communicating with Abeldees once more in Italy, and they're told to kind of write this book that becomes book four, parts one and two.
Which is problematic if we have that initial sort of like, am I to publish it? Never, 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 yeah. never.
And sometimes the book is called 9, and sometimes the book is on a shelf that's labeled 21, and sometimes the book is called 69. And so when you read the published things, right, like Liber 418 seems to hang together pretty beautifully by comparison to stuff like this, mm-hmm. right? Like the holy books are pretty opaque and pretty difficult, and Liber 418 is even denser than some of the other holy books, and then the Book of the Law, supposedly straight narration from
mm-hmm.
the ether, right? He's alone in this room and just receiving this text and writing it down madly. So people might get a misunderstanding of what magical work is supposed to look like. But I suspect that a lot of what Crowley was doing, because there's a lot of these sorts of excerpts in here in the John Simmons book of him working with different seers and recording the diary entries, and the Paris working with Newberg is another example where they're having this kind of conversation. A seer's trying to get visions and Crowley's asking, can you tell me what you're seeing?
Yeah.
The seer has to kind of split their consciousness between seeing and telling. And it's very, very, very muddled.
Mm-hmm.
So if listeners are doing this type of work at home and getting very conflicted, stressful, confusing results, know that better people than you have also gotten this kind of difficult result. Let's actually skip to page 150 and read the last page of the last sort of two pages of this, and then I want to finish by reading this big paragraph at the bottom of 51. But Perturabo says,
"Is Abeldees there?
He has been for some time.
Will he answer questions?
Yes. Tonight there'll be trouble, I feel it.
Why?
Lack of faith. If you'd only believe and go straight.
Who is doubting?
You.
Not at all.
Yes.
You, O seer, have doubted.
Prove me.
W-K-G-U-H-P.
Mary Sturgis possessed a valuable pearl necklace. Crowley, thinking of a supreme test of faith, therefore guarded, keenly asked her, will Curdie give up the pearls? Curdie was the mythical woman who, for laughing at Jesus while he was carrying the cross, was doomed to hopeless remorse for ages. See Wagner's Parsifal. No, not yet.
What will happen in that case?
What happened to you before?
Ah, oh, God. Is it too late?
No, not too late, but too little faith.
Take these in your hand.
Gives her the pearls. Why? They've disappeared. There's nothing left. They no longer exist. Never mind. I'm at home with them. How well they know. Begin with the name of the last letter. Write it. Otherwise, it will add to 22. Begin with Zidluba, O mocker.
What have you done?
I have thrown away the pearls. It was quite right. He tells me so. If you can't give me spiritual gifts and things of value, I don't need anything. I don't need pearls. I need light.
What shall be done with the pearls?
Nothing. They're of no value. Understand. For God's sake, understand.
STPBSTV.
Wait and know. You were answered this question before.
So that's, shall the pearls be sent to VVVVV?
To sum up, the wizard Abeldees, one of the secret chiefs, informed Crowley through Seer Veracam that he was to write a work on magic to be entitled Book 4, and that he and Veracam were to do so in Naples, and Crowley, of course, held on to the pearls. And so there's this adventure that people know about. And here, Simmons says Crowley wrote this, but it's in Sturge's voice. And this is another reason I got confused about who was dictating the book for. Yeah, it says, nearly midnight. At this moment, we stopped dictating and began to converse. Then Frater P said, oh, if only I could dictate a book like the Tao Te Ching. And then he closed his eyes as if meditating. Just before, I had noticed a change in his face, most extraordinary, as if he were no longer the same person. In fact, in 10 minutes we were talking, he seemed to be any number of different people. I especially noticed the pupils of his eyes were so enlarged that the entire eye seemed black. I trembled, so I have such a quaking feeling inside simply in thinking of last night that I can't form letters. Then, quite slowly, the entire room filled with a thick yellow light, deep golden, not brilliant. I mean, not dazzling, but soft. And Frater P looked like a person I have never seen, but seemed to know quite well. His face, clothes, and all were of the same yellow. I was so disturbed that I looked up to the ceiling to see what caused the light, but could only see the candles. And then the chair on which he sat seemed to rise. It was like a throne. He had seemed to be either dead or sleeping, but it was certainly no longer Frater P. This frightened me, and I tried to understand by looking round the room. When I looked back, the chair was raised, and he was still the same. I realized I was alone. And thinking he was dead or gone or some other terrible thing, I lost consciousness. So I had somewhere distant in my mind remembered this paragraph of Crowley entering Samadhi and levitating in front of Mary Sturges, and thought that this was the manner in which he was dictating book four to her, you know. But clearly she sees this. She's so scared she passes out. So they weren't doing this for days on end. Anyway, so this is, I don't know... what value there is in reading this necessarily, except in sort of both showing an example of a record of a kind of working that you can have where there's a seer and an operator working together and having very confusing conversations and precedent for the kind of results you're likely to get if you engage in this work. Also to clarify the record a little bit, because what we said about the reception of magic and theory and practice doesn't actually apply to magic and theory and practice. And then, but there really were spooky things going on around the writing of that book, which, I don't think it counts as a received teaching. I think you're right. I think they wrote it together, but they were told again and again and again that they were going to be given this book. And if a spirit, if one of the secret chiefs is giving them the book, that makes it seem, that makes it, that the feeling is that it's received, even if through Crowley's own ingenium rather than through, you know, direct dictation, the way the Book of the Law was or something.
Yeah, it's also nice because this brings to mind, I mean, we just sort of glanced past that diary record of Crowley's dreams while he was traveling through America, and the fact that Simmons was disdainful of the fact that there's no notes taken on the subject, just cold records made of the dreams. And to me, that seems like very good in terms of the initial record to just take note of everything, but the lack of any kind of analysis after the fact, it is kind of a good sort of good note to make for any student. It's good to be able to assess your dreams as well and try to get some kind of insight into them. But yeah, so in this case, like a good example would be the Paris working, where you have the records taken during the actual working, which you just take notes and everything. You do it scientifically in that respect. And then after the fact, there's also the assessment that goes along with each of the workings, which kind of gives a rundown of, you know, a little bit of the filling in the blanks and maybe addressing any of the results that they saw after the fact and that sort of thing. So that's also kind of a worthwhile thing to have in the back of your head.
Anyway, I strongly recommend this book to listeners. Like I said, if I had just seen it on the shelf, I would have kind of written it off, but it was on Keith 418's reading list and I picked it up. He was saying how valuable it was to have a hostile biographer of Crowley, and not only the hostility, which allows him to talk about things other people might gloss, but also his willingness to quote liberally from papers that not everyone has seen. You know, you get these little bits of insights into material that exist that you might not get in other places.
That's a very good point. And actually, that's something I learned particularly from reading biographies on Crowley, is that it's really important to read more than one, ideally at least three if possible, because of the fact that you get such a triangulation, especially on such a polarizing character as Crowley. But any character, if you're reading a biography, if you can read three different biographies, you're going to get a very different sort of take from each of them.
Mm-hmm,
so.
Mm-hmm. Hey, what's on your summer reading list?
Let's see. I want to get through the writings of St. John of the Cross, just to be able to engage with that and pretty much say I did. But yeah, so there's that.
Say something about that. What's the writings of St. John of the Cross?
Well, he was, you know, early Renaissance, I guess, or maybe just coming up. I think he was 1500, so pretty much contemporary with John D.
Okay, okay.
If I'm not mistaken. But he, maybe a little bit earlier, but he was living in Spain, Toledo, I want to say. And he was like an important member of the church and that sort of thing, but he also had controversies kind of associated with him to some extent. But he was very much the mystic. He was imprisoned at one point and had some like strong, powerful mystical experiences there. And his poetry is really, really profound. And this is, from what I understand, this is where we get the term the Dark Night of the Soul.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Mm-hmm. So one of those great examples, again, as sort of a triangulation thing, and also thinking of it in terms of like, if you're offended by Christianity, well, then put that aside, because once again, we're looking at various sources throughout the ages who are all experiencing essentially the same principles at work, the same natural functions at work, parsed through their own worldview, their own context. So it's kind of nice to be able to have those kinds of sources for that.
Yeah, I mean, having Nietzsche and other Masons on the saint list is Nietzsche and other Masons. yeah, the value of the Oxford comma. Having Nietzsche and Mason and some Masonic people on the saints list, but you know, also a huge number of Christian mystics and people who were former popes and stuff like that. Although, yeah, evil popes. But what else are you looking at?
Well, you give me one.
So I'm going to try to finish King of the Shadow Realm. I also bought a book called The Toronto Book of the Dead.
Ooh.
Let me see if I can look up the author, because I've read the first kind of 100 pages and it's really good so far. So the guy's name is Adam Brunch. And so what I understand is, and again, I might get this wrong because I'm just learning about him, is that he is the artist behind something called the Toronto Dream Project, where he researches historical figures who existed in historical places around the city and writes them hypothetical dreams that they might have had at different points in their lives, and not only blogs these dreams, but then makes hard copies of the literary work, and then leaves them at places around the city where these historical figures may have visited.
Interesting.
And then he's also got several books of the history of Toronto, and the Toronto Book of the Dead is sort of a series of short stories about historical people and characters and how they experienced loss. And so one of the things is the wife of the founder of York. I can't remember her first name, but it's something Posthuma Simcoe. And so her middle name is Posthuma because her mother was born the day she died. And then her father, who was a soldier out, you know, somewhere,
so Posthuma,
died before they met. So she was like, she's a child who was raised posthumously by, you know, like orphan from day one. And then it talks about, you know, the founding of the city and her work with her husband, Simcoe, who's the founder of York. But then also about how you know, she has seven children and then survives five of them. And so there's this and, you know, the interesting histories of interesting places like the Toronto Necropolis. And so, cool. Yeah, it's really, really neat little book for anyone who's interested in the local history cool. around here.
I'd love to. Yeah, because the Toronto Necropolis is a really cool place. And I mean, we went on a little Toronto Thelema pilgrimage to George A. Romero's gravesite there.
Was he Canadian? I didn't realize.
No, he was really strongly attached with Pittsburgh. That was where he was originally, you know, from and everything. But he ended up moving to Toronto after filming some films up here, and just I imagine just, you know, falling into like with the place or whatnot.
Well, that's cool. The Necropolis was I guess it was early on in a wave of something called the Garden Cemetery, which was this sort of thing around the world where, rather than being in churchyards, these beautiful cemeteries were built just on the outskirts of cities, so that people could have some sort of public land to go to play on that would be away from, so they could get some sort of reprieve from early urban life, have a place to go and have picnics and go on walks and, you know, throw whatever the 19th century equivalent of a Frisbee was, probably still a Frisbee, and sort of be in a sort of pleasant rural part environment. But also commune.
Makes sense that right across from it is the Riverdale farm there.
And so this would have been when it was first, you know, when the first several thousand people were buried there. This would have been like both a community hub, but a place that was on the just outside of what we think of as Toronto. And now, of course, it's right fucking downtown because the, you know, cities only expand. Yeah. But there's
except insofar as the Don Valley's right there falling away from it. But, but no, that's very cool. And it's kind of nice to be able to bring some Torontoania. Sorry, I felt really terrible getting over that word. Just bringing some of that into the podcast is nice.
And also I think I might finally read Moonchild.
That might be kind of a fun one to do. We don't have to obviously do the entire book, but maybe we can, in reading it, you and maybe I'll revisit myself, we could find a portion of it to discuss or something along those lines.
Yeah, because these novels are, I'm surprised how often these novels are the first thing people pick up. It seems to me unlikely. An unlikely first introduction to Crowley, because he is not notoriously a great writer of fiction, although I think he wanted to be. But I guess people suspect that novels are going to be more accessible or something. Actually, Diary of a Drug Fiend, I think, is often, because people assume it's his actual diary.
Yeah. What's her face? Dionne Fortune. A lot of people recommend her fiction writings as actually very insightful for magical purposes and whatnot. But there's a portion of Moonchild where his character, I want to say Simon If, but I don't know if it's actually Simon If or it's just the kind of like similar character. I'm blanking now, but he talks about the Holy Guardian Angel, like the idea of genius working through you, and you are essentially like the secretary taking notes for that genius that's working through you. And it's a really beautiful analogy that I like to refer to, so I should damn well know the name of the character that's talking about it by this point.
That's a good enough reason to look at it.
Yeah.
Anything else on your nightstand for the next 3 months?
Well, you know what? I just finished reading something, so I think now that I'm trying to panic and think of what I was planning on looking at, I might just be between things at the moment. But I just finished reading the Gospel According to Saint Bernard Shaw, with along, you know, comparing it directly to the preface to Bernard Shaw's Androcles and the Lion. Which is really the way to do it. I think the first time I'd read it, or I don't even know if I got through the whole thing, but the first time I read it, I was just reading it in isolation, which is nonsensical.
that was on our list for something to possibly cover this season. Mm-hmm. And then we were shocked by the length of it. I think 70,000 words or something like that, yeah. A book length essay. But you managed to get through it, did you?
Yeah. And I think there's one or two portions that I've isolated that I think would be worthwhile maybe doing an episode on.
Okay. Okay. All right, so I will have to fight through that as well. I like the idea of we've talked about this before, but the AA, is it called the syllabus? There's those 55 sort of books that are recommended to AA students for serious study, and then there's another 60 plus that are recommended as sort of inspiration. Mm-hmm. And I feel like the
foundation of a good library,
the second half of that list gets ignored. Mm-hmm. and maybe with good reason, because you know so much of it is fiction or whatever. But I do think it's fun. You know, I love these like horror movies about ghost stories or possessions or something like that, because I feel that watching these scary movies, it sort of connects me to the spiritual world. Mm. And it makes me think, you know, think about practice and maybe more inclined. If I watch The Exorcist on Friday, maybe I'm more inclined to do some evocation work on Saturday. And so there is something to this idea of injecting your recreational reading with inspirational material as well.
You could make an argument that the imagination itself is a major factor in magical practice, insofar as it's sort of like the medium or part of the medium by which we work. So yeah, sparking off, inspiring the imagination is like, that makes a hell of a lot of sense, frankly.
So I don't want to devote an entire series to fictional works, but if we could look at either Moonchild or Diary of a Drug Fiend, or one of the other ones on that list, you know, like I think Dracula's on there, or, you know, maybe... is there something called the Magus on there? I sent you a short list of ones that I thought were probable a while ago. So maybe getting some fiction into the cast next year. Although it's harder to discuss without just doing like a plot recap, which I don't want to do.
No,
but we could speak about it thematically.
You know? And even if we're... you know, not necessarily on the same point. It could be similar to our idea of, you know, looking at movies or TV series as thelemic allegories. They don't necessarily have to be the intention of the author. It could be a way in which you can engage with it that way.
Sure. Or like what Crowley thinks is important about this is a good question, because he's recommending all these weird books and you're like, what's this about?
Yeah. Dracula, clearly, because you want to be basically leeching off of people.
Yeah. Yeah, like, yeah, dining out on someone else's dime.
Yeah.
Sleeping with someone else's wife.
Yeah.
Look, I get the sense that we're sort of winding down. Anything else you wanted to bring to the table today?
Well, I guess, do you have any other thoughts on like things we could be looking forward to in future seasons?
Yeah, so I guess we need to do John St. John. I think now that I've mentioned it, we should look at some of the yoga classics that Crowley wants you to look at. His reading list for yoga is short. He says you should read 8 lectures on yoga, book 4, part 1, 1 or 2 Indian classics, and that's all.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at the AA reading list, he says which Indian classics, the Hatha Yoga Pradipika, the Shiva Sanhita, and the Yoga Sutta of Patanjali via Swami Vivekananda. So right there. And since we've already sort of talked about so much of the Crowley approach to yoga, looking at some of these more radical practices of the kind of, you know, the way the wandering saints practice some of these crazy, dangerous, you know, health maintenance things, it might be fun, although they're difficult to read because they're often translated by very idiosyncratic people. that would be worth doing. I like the idea of looking at it may be Crowley in India or the or one of the
Gordon's paper.
Gordon's book. Yeah. So you know, all these things are on the table. And at some point, it's a good, it would be a good time to do the first of the five books of Genealogy of Morals. Because
yeah, it'd be nice to get into some Nietzsche.
I do think that that's important, and we keep Nietzsche comes up on the cast a lot, but we haven't formally addressed any of it. And so, getting our ideas on that clear,
and expressing and beginning
to express an interpretation, is probably a good idea.
Yeah, and we might end up revisiting that and being like, "What the fuck?" I also, any way in which we can touch on skepticism further as well.
Mm-hmm.
I actually just yesterday, I think somebody from the community was expressing that she's like an astronomer, essentially. She's like working in astronomy, an astronomical observatory and that sort of thing. So she's huge into the science end of things and was suggesting that putting a focus on that skeptical end of things, which I think we do to some extent, but it's always nice to explore that further.
Well, Crowley has a couple of writings on this, Soldier and the Hunchback.
Mm-hmm.
He talks about the difference between vital skepticism and sort of, you know, something that's a more sincere questioning. I sometimes think it sucks the fun out of it. or the preface to the Mathers translation of the Goetia, too. He talks in this sort of way about, you know, the demons being...
Which
parts
I think
of the brain,
yeah,
or things like
that
this.
Being an early writing of his, I feel like it's, yeah, it's especially sucks the fun out of it. But I'm sure we could find something in Magic and Theory, or sorry, Magic Without Tears, like one of the letters in there, for instance,
sure.
We could revisit.
One we keep putting off is Bereshit, a note in ontology.
Yeah, is that the one that's by Alan Bennett?
No, that's so there is a Bereshit by Alan Bennett. There's also a Bereshit spelled backwards, which is about but then this is the Bereshit that is
most commonly in Crowley's collected.
It's the one he keeps referring you to talk about his ontology and what he thinks counts as objects that exist in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very difficult and not always right. Like he makes some mistakes in it. So it's hard for a number of reasons, but, and then also more David Hume. Hume has some essays, right?
Which are
his masterpieces of skepticism in prose. So if somebody's looking for more,
Clicks be damned. It's important. We're interested. So.
Well, no, I mean, I'm not sure I'm interested, but they're on the reading list and they've been specifically requested. So someone's saying they want skepticism. Crowley says, this is the masterpiece of skepticism.
Exactly.
So let's do it.
We could look at Huxley as well.
Yeah.
And some of the other philosophical writers. But yeah, that's great. So I think that pretty much ties things up. I don't know if you had anything else that comes to mind that you'd like to touch on before we wrap up this season.
No, I think my two big soapboxes were the Mary Sturgis chapter of Shadow Realm and this thing about how you could do worse than Crowley studying yoga. I think I'm ready to see you next month.
Great. Okay. And I think I'll rebrand this instead of being just the check-in episode, which nobody's interested in. Maybe I'll find a sexy, seductive title to give this instead.
Just call it Frothy Sexy Summer Reading List.
Yeah. Just call it Sex Magic Revealed. And then you'll be suffering through us. Okay, well, thanks for joining me as usual.
We'll re-record everything and I'll be breathier.
Yeah, exactly. We'll go over everything just talking like this over top. All right. Love is the law. Love under will.
Love is the law. Love under will.
We'll be right back. this concludes season 4. As always, thanks for listening. Keep an eye out for new episodes after a brief hiatus, and join us again in the Darkly Splendid.
Even in philosophy, there may be people who say, "Oh, that person's not read anymore because they're seen as minor." Whereas for
doesn't
Crowley,
take into
that was important
account
or
postmodernism.
Something.
Sorry, I have put that on airplane mode, so I don't know how the hell that's happening.
Well, it must be really important then.
Yeah. Well, maybe I didn't put it on airplane. That's what happens when your vision starts to go. Sorry about that.
It's okay. We're all getting older. We're all getting older.
What's that?
What? That way you can just say pardon for the next 15 minutes.
Yeah. At least I have my hearing.
Pardon?